Session number 21554, Reel 2.
Tell us what was involved in actually leaving Australia. You, I presume, went to Fremantle?
We marched into northern town from the camp, and then we entrained, and I think someone said it was the biggest train that had ever been pulled in Western Australia. I think it was, I don't know for sure, 17 coaches or some big thing, down to Fremantle Wharf, and we embarked on a water tanker or a tanker of some, a little thing called the Corumba or something like that. We went on the Queen Mary, and we were taken out on this little thing out to the side of the Queen Mary. There were only two ships in the convoy in this particular time, the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth. And until you have been aboard those ships, you've got no conception of their size or whatsoever. When you pull up alongside this thing, alongside it, and went in through the gun ports, I think they call them, the side of the ship. The first, since we'd put our gear in, we didn't have cabins, we're in, I think there was 30 of us, and we were in an area that was, had a notice, have something for 10 seamen or something like that. But once you put your gear there, we were taken to breakfast. But when you went in to breakfast, they used to sit 2,000 at a time in the dining room. And you went into one end of the dining room, but you couldn't go out that end, you had to go out the other end. So then you didn't have a clue whereabouts in the ship you were. It took you at least half an hour to get back to where you'd come into it.
You're getting yourself lost.
Many times on the ship, I can tell you.
On your way down to Fremantle, what thoughts were going through your mind about the experience?
Well, just that the time has come. The time has come, we're going to be there, we're going to be in it. We're going there and we're going to be with our mates.
How did that make you feel?
On a high, yeah, on a high.
Were there people...
It was new, something you knew was, had to happen. It was only a matter of time. And you used to get pretty... We were getting pretty impatient after 9 months that we hadn't been given the opportunity, because that's why... It's the reason you enlisted, was to go there, to do your thing.
Mm. What about on your way down? Were there people to say goodbye?
No. Well, it was dark, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
What sorts of things did you talk about amongst yourselves in the train?
No, I couldn't honestly tell you that, John. No, not to be honest, no.
Arriving at Fremantle, what was the feeling on the wharf?
Well, we went straight. I forget just exactly what berth it was, but you went straight from the train over to this little tanker thing we'd taken out, so you didn't even see many people. It was probably cordoned off, I suppose, from
where? How long did it take?
From northern. Oh, probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, I suppose.
So by the time you got to the train at Fremantle and you disembarked from the train, how long did it take for you to actually get onto the Queen Mary?
No, I honestly couldn't tell you that either. Because it was only, you know, she's only probably halfway out to Rottnest or something like that.
Did you have time to think about what was going on?
No. I think it's just something you expected to happen, or you were expecting this to come along all the time. And I say, having had 9 months of training, you were expecting this all the time. It wasn't as if you'd just been, had it dropped on you, you know, suddenly.
What had you been told by your superiors about what was going to happen?
My recollections of that are not really clear, John. I couldn't tell you that. I could tell you some experiences on the Queen Mary because of the size of them. For instance, because I had a couple of stripes on one occasion, because I had the stripes, and on one occasion, I had the section that I was in charge of had to go down and guard number 3 or whatever it was, galley. And when we went down to guard it, the chap in front of me, his bootlaces and done, he stopped to do it up. And I was at the end, back of the section, and by the time he did that, we never found the rest of the section. So that was the end of that. Another occasion when we had a similar job to do, we couldn't find the galley we had to get, so we just went back to it. No one missed us. But that's the size of the ship. It was incredible. You know, and we were on for, it took us 12 and a half days travelling. We went to Trichomalee, which is the southern part of Ceylon. We were there for 36 hours, I think, and then we went on to Port Chiffick. So we were only 12 and a half days from Fremantle on a ship of that size, zigzagging all the way, the speed that they travel at.
Can you tell us what your experience was when you saw...
The Middle East?
No, before we get there. when you saw the horizon of Western Australia disappear in the distance, what feelings and thoughts went through your mind?
We were just looking forward, I think, all the time, John. Didn't think back at all about it. No.
Tell us about the conditions on board ship. What sort of conditions?
Well, the food was good, but the living conditions were pretty rough. As I said, there were 30 of us, I think, and I think it had fit for 10 able seamen or something. We were very crowded in there. Well, I think there were 8,000 of us on it. There were 15,000 on the two ships. You met people on the ships who were crew, peacetime crew, and they would tell wonderful stories about the peacetime of the taking all the film stars around the world and attending to them and the steward and this sort of thing.
What were some of those stories? Do you recall?
Oh no, not offhand. No, but no, I can't recall the particular stories. But I remember they were quite exciting at the time, you know. But a couple of things I remember of the size of the ship too was that. To stand at the bottom, because you don't have it now, of the forward mast and look up at the tremendous side, or to go right up in the bow of the ship and look over the side, and then you can realise how some people are tempted to jump when they see a height like that. And the travelling of those two ships, because in the daytime they travel side by side with a cruiser out in front, because we were told, and I quite believe it was true too, that nothing could catch the two queens. The only way that anything could possibly have happened to them was if a submarine sat in wait for them, which was an impossibility because they zigged out all over the place. And on one occasion, the cruiser apparently, we could just see this smoke or something away on the horizon, apparently sent a message to whatever was on the horizon and got the wrong answer. And the word must have come back to the two ships to split up. And when they went, because side by side, like if you were travelling with another car on the road, you don't feel the speed. But when they parted and went opposite directions, you realised that they were pushing, I know they can do it now, but in those days, pushing 84,000 tonnes through water and doing about 30 mile an hour, 30 knots, something like that. It was incredible. In that day and age, it was incredible, really, isn't it? That must have been a wonderful thing in peacetime. Well, it was an experience for me. I'd tell the grandkids, talk about big ships. I said, oh, well, I had a trip in the Queen Mary.
By that stage, had it been completely sort of decked out for troop carrying?
No, it hadn't been. No, because where we were, and it was so hot down below too, where we were, I think we were on E deck or something, that we used to sleep quite often up on the promenade deck. The only trouble was about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the crew would come round and hose the decks down, but still you had got a few hours of decent sleep, which you wouldn't have got down below. And I think they run round, to go around, we used to have sports on board, actually to keep you fed. And I think around the promenade deck the whole way around was a quarter mile or something like that, some fantastic figure anyway. And it was a hell of a distance. Tremendous things they were.
So how would you pass the day then?
Oh, with training, lectures and training, yeah. Sport, physical training, phys ed, that sort of thing, and lectures most of the time.
What did the phys ed involve?
Oh, like you had at school, arms and that sort of thing. Doing this sort of thing.
And how many men would be doing that at a time on the deck of the Queen Mary?
Oh, well, there was a platoon of us, so we'd have all done it together. Like in our group was a platoon, so we'd have done the platoon. It was when I went in the middle, at that stage, I wasn't with the battalion I finished up with. We were reinforcements for the 2nd 48th Battalion. But when we got to the Middle East, the 2nd 48th didn't need reinforcement at the time, so we were transferred to the 2nd 3rd Machine Gun Battalion. Fortunately for me, I don't actually remember my brother's name, but there were three of us in this unit, or with this reinforcement. Three of us had elder brothers, as it so happened, in the 2nd 16th Battalion, and we must have all been asked by our elder brothers if we wanted to go there. Luckily I did, because the 2nd 3rd Machine Gunners all went off in Malaya on the way back. They were attached to us, as a matter of fact, they were part of the 7th Division, attached to the 21st Brigade, and when we were coming home from Middle East, this is further on, of course, they were in a faster ship than us, and they landed in Malaya. We didn't get there. Our ship was, I think it was 1904 or something, it was a little old coal burner, a horrible thing, and they landed. So had I been with them, I would have finished up that's fate. That's why I say maybe when I didn't get my call-up straight away, who knows, I might have been like this chap whose father said he would be a great soldier. It could have been the first day and you could have gone, you don't know. That's from things that happened to me afterwards, I'm sure that when your number is up, when you're wanted, you go, and that's it, and you don't get any say in it.
We can talk about that.
Yeah, positive of that.
How did you get on with the rest of the men on board? What was the feeling that you established?
Personally, I got on very well with them. I had a very good rapport with my mates in it. I've always been I was always a quiet person. Talk a bit more now as you get older, but I was very quiet. But I always had a very good rapport. And a lot of the chaps I was with, which was the case with a lot of units, you had a lot of Goldfields members. They had a tremendous recruitment area in the Goldfields. In fact, in the unit I finished up with, the 2nd 16th, a platoon in each company came from the Goldfields. I think there was some figure like 273 came down the one train load from Kalgoorlie to enlist. And there were a lot of them in the reinforcement unit that I was with when I went away. A lot of Goldfielders, and they were the sort of blokes that were easy to get on with anyone.
Why do you think they were so enthusiastic?
Oh, the lifestyle of the miner. Well, it's a typical Australian lifestyle, really, isn't it? Very much so. As a matter of fact, we had the 16th, I'm not just saying, it was a pretty tough unit. They had a very good record, and I was speaking to chaps from other units and said, you know, they said, why do you reckon your blokes, you know, get so much of a boost that way? I said, well, I think the fact that we had so many miners amongst us. I said, oh, we had miners. I said, but nowhere near the number that we had. We had so many of them. And I think it's probably a lot to do with this. The lifestyle of a miner down below, as they are, where their life, a bit like, not as bad admittedly, but their life is a bit like being in the army, in as much as from day to day, even now in this day and age, there's so many lives are lost down below, aren't they? And they adopt a comradeship amongst themselves. I feel positive of that. I've thought of that in hindsight, that probably is why they had such a great camaraderie amongst themselves in the services, because of their lifestyle in the mines down below.
Did you talk about, you know, the future with your mates and what was likely to happen?
No. I can't ever remember mentioning that at all. Well, I think you just live for the present, like most servicemen do. During wartime, I think you're living for the present.
Did it ever come into your mind the thought that you might not make it back?
No, not at all. In fact, you used to joke about it a bit, and strangely enough, it happened almost to me. You know, and lots of blokes said, oh, well, anyway, I'd get shot, would be shot in the bum. And strangely enough, I got shot from behind, but wasn't exactly in the bum, but I got shot from behind, but only because they were in front and behind us at the time, and I had no option. But I don't ever remember hearing people. I know some people say that they felt something was going to happen, but I've never experienced that or heard anyone else talk that way at all. Maybe it's different. Say in the First World War, where chaps were in trenches day in, day out, week in, week out, whereas at our time, in our days, it was the blokes in the Bruck could have experienced it because they were probably the only blokes who were ever immobilised for such a long period, you know, whereas most of other chaps, even when they were in action, they were mobile to a certain extent, to a large extent.
What is sort of making light of the situation? Was that something that you experienced on the voyage? People avoiding talking about?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think anyone avoided anything. One of the funniest, silly things that I do remember is, not to do with that really, but at mealtime, blokes who couldn't handle the sea and that wouldn't eat their fair meal, but it never went to waste because the bloke alongside him ate the meal that he didn't eat. But
How then was morale sort of kept up on board?
Well, it was always very high. Of course, it was such a short, and you were going to a new experience, a new country, and it was such a short trip really, time-wise, you know, 12 and a half days of travelling, it was comparatively, because you're on a ship that you took you so long, you didn't know where you were. You know, if it had been a little thing, like our trip home took 6 weeks, a little old car, but we'll go into that further on later on. But
what were some of the lectures that you were to experience?
On tactics, practically most of it's in regard to tactics. Yeah. I think sometimes you're also warned in your lectures to keep away from the female train on the other side of the country, the dangers of that sort of thing, which everyone is taught to do, you know, take your precautions. And
What were some of the tactics that you were being taught on board ship, do you think?
No, I couldn't remember just offhand. I really couldn't, John, not without making it up.
I understand that, you know, sort of entertainment was made up by the chaps. Did that?
No, we didn't have any. No, we didn't have any at all. No. No, we didn't have any entertainment whatsoever, not even a picture show.
What was it like then to arrive in...
Well, I remember that well because it was such a clear blue sky and all you could see was almost nothing because that's what Port Chufet was like, just flat and desolate looking. And I remember thinking to myself, gee, is this the Middle East? There's nothing very glamorous about it.
What was it like to stop at your first port? You mentioned that you spent 36 hours in...
That was in Trincomalee on the way over. See, that's on the bottom of... You were warned not to try and... Not that you were going to. You're in a big bay at Trincomalee and not to go over. So I think you could get to the shore because the place is full of sharks, which is probably a bit of bulldust because that was to make sure no one dived over the side. But not much chance of you diving over the side from the ship just to get into the town from a ship the size of the Queen Mary. You'd probably be like jumping off Sydney Harbour Bridge or something like that.
So you weren't able to have leave?
No, not at all. No, it was only there for bunkering and restocking of food, I suppose, with such a big 8,000 people, you know, on board. And
did you change ships at all?
Not on the way over, no, just the one trip. We did on the way home, but not on the way over.
So as you got closer to the Middle East, what was it like going up? Presumably
without
the Red
Sea. Yeah, the Red... I don't... No particular memory. No.
What precautions are being taken on board ship, other than the zigzag?
Complete blackout, you know. Well, I do think that when we got very near there, I think something nearly did clean us up. As a matter of fact, I remember quite a commotion going on. So something... Can you imagine in the dark, you know, and they're pretty, you know, pretty hard to manoeuvre a ship like that because they have right away because they're so big. But I think something did... But there was quite a commotion one night and it... And I believe something did get pretty close to us.
Who were your close mates on board ship, do you recall?
Yes. It's one of them was one of the chaps who finished up. Two of them, in fact, both of the chaps who were quite close mates of mine, chaps who finished up with me in the 2nd 16th, and we all finished up in the same platoon in the 2nd 16th, in fact. Chap Herbie Dorr and Norm Boyce, they're gone now, but... within the platoon, of course, you have your sections of, and then the platoon, which is, you know, about 33 all told with your sergeants and corporals, but you were all good mates. You'd go and leave, and even if one in your section, but it was somebody else in the other section, but you were all part of that platoon, didn't matter which ones you went on leave with.
So tell us, what was it like to finally get to your destination?
You're here. We're here, yeah. Of course, the first warning you got there when you went into your tent, because they had the big, what they call EPIP tents. I forget just how many were too. The first thing you had to be told was, because they had a pole in the middle of the tent, was to, they had a chain around the pole, and that had to be, your rifle had to be chained to that pole, because due respect to the people of the locals of the Middle East, if you didn't, they'd come in at night time just like to pinch your rifle, so you had to chain your rifles up every night to the pole in the middle of the tent. Yeah.
What was it like to disembark into this strange new place?
Oh, well, one of the things I can remember, the locals wanted to sell cooked eggs and things like that, you know, and their dress for their I won't use the expression in regard to what we referred to their dress, so I can, you can cut out. Used to refer to them as shit catchers because you can edit that out if you like, John. But things like that, they were trying to sell you oranges or something like that. Of course, you're always warned not to buy food from, like people are when they go up into, say, even to Bali or to places like that. Now, be careful where you buy your food.
Did you I assume you had never made a sort of world trip like this before.
I had, but I didn't remember it as a child. My parents had gone back to Scotland when I was about five or something, so I didn't have any recollections of it at all.
But what was it then like? What was the feeling that you had when you finally arrived?
Well,
seeing this strange.
Although you were only in Palestine, which is only the training area, there was never any action in Palestine in this war. There was the first war. Once you were there, you felt you were part of it, that you were there. You know, I think that was the main feeling, that we are here at last after all this time. You know, 9, 10 months, at last we're here.
How did you get to Palestine from?
We went by train from Port Chifre to Alcantara, and then another train from Alcantara to, well, a camp we were at was called Mugazi. All the different, some were named by numbers, Hill 69, Hill 95, but our camp was named Mugazi.
And what was it then like, sort of realising, okay, we're getting closer to this thing called war.
Mm.
What was it like to be feeling that you were getting closer to that?
Well, I suppose a certain amount of excitement within yourself that you were, now, not fearing, but I think a feeling of excitement that you were going to soon be why you had enlisted, you know.
You mentioned a little bit about what you had understood had gone on further up in the Western Desert.
Mm. Well, this was only when we got to the Middle East that we found us out, because we were reinforcements for a unit that was going up there but hadn't had the casualties and didn't need us up there.
What then were you hearing on arrival about the situation at the time? You mentioned that you saw lots of Italian prisoners.
Oh, well, that was a prisoner of war. That was on the train from Port Chifre to Alcantara on the first train. Yeah, on the first half of the journey. Yeah.
What then was the sense of confidence or lack of at the time?
Confidence when you realise how many. Probably not realising at the time the difference between the Italian and the German soldier, but perhaps, I suppose, in the back of your mind you're thinking how comparatively easy it was going to be when you saw how many prisoners were. But still, I suppose, in hindsight or retrospect, what about happened in Singapore where our own chaps were taken by the, I don't mean just Australians, but the Allies were taken by 100,000, weren't they? You know, I don't know what the figure was in Singapore, but it would have been nearly as bad numerically as what it was for the Italians being taken, but under different circumstances, admittedly. I mean, as you know, as well as I do, what a botch up it was. They can't attack us from behind, they can only attack us from the front. That was a bit like us in New Guinea. See, they reckon Moresby, in the first place, for all the great skill of MacArthur and Blamey, they only thought that Moresby could be taken from Moresby. They didn't think it could be taken. You'd have thought, I know I'm digressing, but you would have thought with the experience of Singapore that they should have been more prepared that, well, maybe they can attack us from the north and not from the south to get to Moresby, which is what the Japs did do. I suppose they thought, well, we've done this in Singapore, we'll do it in Moresby too. Yeah.
I'm interested to know what sort of level of confidence you had in your commanding officers.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very good. Unfortunately, in that case, although we didn't go to the battalion, the 748th, our officers did, and I'm given to understand that they both got killed within a day or so of each other, as it so happened when they were up there.
Can you name them for us? Come back to talking about them if you like that. What about sort of higher up, people in charge of the army, the confidence that you had in the Australian politicians, that sort of thing?
No, can't say I thought that great amount about politically over there, but I think we, at the time we had great respect for the people who were running the whole show, and particularly at the finish with Winwin New Guinea with the our brigadier, because he had a wonderful name, Arnold Potts. He got a terrible treatment from the hierarchy, but he was someone that you knew that whatever he said and whatever he did, you just did it, and you knew that he'd be on the right track.
We can talk about him later on.
Yeah.
Menzies was still in power.
And then, yeah. Mm.
He was to be defeated in August of 41.
Mm.
And then it would be after Fadden, Curtin.
Mm.
What about your feelings towards people like Churchill, for instance?
I think just felt at that stage that they were doing it, setting a great example, I think, at that stage. Can't say I never really had any great thoughts about what was going on outside. You were more interested in what you're doing yourself. I mean, John, that was your first priority. Why you were there and what you were going to do. Which you're going to do it irrespective of who's up there and who's not there.
I'm interested to know whether you had an opportunity to speak to anyone else who had experienced war, obviously before you became involved, and what they may have told you about the experience that they'd had, possibly in the Western Desert.
No, and I didn't even discuss it with my brother, whom I met. He had come back and when he claimed me into the unit, but I never discussed it with him, as a matter of fact. No.
So he'd been up in the Western Desert, hadn't he?
No, but he... No, just what happened there. Well, I don't think he got... Because he suffered badly, like a lot did with malaria. And a lot of the chaps, as happened in New Guinea too, there were just as many casualties through sickness as there were from battle casualties. And I think he hadn't seen the whole of the Syrian campaign through before he went down with malaria and dysentery in both cases. And that's when he came down. He visited me at our camp in Palestine. But we didn't discuss the war. We didn't discuss the fighting. No.
He was to be involved in the Syrian camp,
though, yeah,
against the Vichy French. Mm. We can talk about that later too. I wanted to ask you, you know, what the situation was regarding training and what you're being told about, you know, where you might be heading on.
Well, the countryside is very much alike right through those places, except for the hills of Syria and Lebanon. But the wadis and that sort of thing, that's where, you know, the sort of dried out creeks, whatever they one time creeks or rivers had been, the wadis were the sort of things where you always seem to have your stunts where you had sort of like a fortress as you come up the other side, but you know. And it was a similar type training to what we had in Australia, except that you didn't have trees. You know, it was all just barren country.
So did you know where you were going to be sent ultimately at that point?
Oh, we felt that you would go up as reinforcement up into Syria, yeah.
So what were you hearing about that situation at the time?
Well, they were having success, so I think that you weren't greatly worried about it because they were having quite a bit of success there around the peace.
What have you heard about the situation, for instance, at Tobruk at that point? The siege had begun, as far as I understand, in April of 1941.
Yeah. I think, I might be wrong on this, I think in lots of cases like this that you're, unless something terrible had happened, like when we were in the Eastern States after we came back and we heard that the 9th Division had been taken prisoner of war. I think unless something most unusual like, well, I don't mean it wasn't unusual for the siege of Tobruk, but I think when you felt that people were doing their part, that you were more really interested in the one that you were going to do and the part that your unit was going to be involved in. I think you felt just that they were doing their part wherever they might be.
Have you heard, for instance, of the evacuation of the Allied troops from Greece?
Yeah. Mm.
What had you heard?
Oh, we just knew that they'd had to get out. That the I think I remember hearing something about the parachutists and that had caused so much trouble there that they weren't prepared for. Although I did hear just recently they never tried that again, the Germans.
Because pretty impressive sight, I understand.
It would have to been, wouldn't it? They didn't try, I believe they didn't try, I think I saw one of these Australians at war or somewhere, where they didn't try and do that again because they had such terrible casualties, and yet the Allies did it at Normandy, didn't they? And the casualties must have been terrible.
What was the feeling then when the Germans were sort of getting closer? They sort of besieged Tobruk and they were pushing people down Greece?
Not a particular worry, I don't think. I think ours were in a different direction up in Syria, and that was your only... I suppose you feel, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, maybe you feel, well, eventually we'll hold them, stop them and get back again. Maybe we're overconfident, I know. I think Australians do get pretty confident. I don't mean cocky either. I think they do get pretty confident that we will out, that it will happen.